Hello, everybody. This is Chris with the Come This Far podcast with Chris Taylor. Today's episode is brought to you by Freshly.com. Quality meals delivered right to your door. Get $40 off your first 2 weeks. Go to Freshly.com. Let Freshly do the cooking for you. With Freshly, you can choose from a variety of delicious, fresh, and healthy chef-cooked meals, which are delivered right to your door. All you have to do is heat for 3 minutes, making mealtime and cleanup easier than before. You know, if your family's like mine, things get a little hectic, especially during school and sports seasons. Freshly will send you freshly cooked meals to your door, not frozen. They'll be fresh. Put them in the refrigerator, heat them up, and they are amazing. They do not taste like TV dinners. They taste like real home-cooked meals, and they're delivered directly to your door. You pick your meals from the constantly rotating weekly menu of 30-plus different gluten-free options. All of your meals are prepared and cooked by professional chefs and delivered fresh, never frozen. No shopping, no chopping, no cleanup. Freshly chefs take care of the meal prep for you, from perfecting the meals on your weekly menu to sourcing the best ingredients. And there's nothing artificial about it. They use only high-quality ingredients to make fresh meals. No artificial preservatives or colors, no added refined sugars, and no gluten. Just nutrient-rich food you can feel good about. Heat, eat, enjoy. Save an hour on dinner by heating one of their fully prepared nutritious meals in just 3 minutes. What are you going to do with all that saved time? Let them do the shopping, the prepping, and cooking for you. For customers like you, Freshly has a limited special time offer. 2 weeks of dinners cooked by their chefs for $40 off. It's normally $56.94 per week. Go to Freshly.com today. Actually, go to try.freshly.com for the special offer, limited time only. try.freshly.com. try.freshly.com. You know, some people think that I tell my story to get praise or to, you know, be on the news or be on shows like this. And you don't realize how difficult it is to become so vulnerable and to open your family up to that scrutiny. But I know how important it is, because when a news segment airs, I get hundreds and sometimes thousands of comments and messages and people who are suffering in silence, and they tell me how much inspiration they get. And so I don't want my struggles and everything that I've suffered to be in vain. Like, I really believe that God gives people struggles and trials to overcome them and then to be that hope and help to other people.
And a Safford City Council member is suspending his campaign for Congress.
A Safford City Councilman has suspended his campaign for Congress after suffering a heroin overdose.
His name is Chris Taylor. You may actually know the name very well. It's been very publicized here in the Arizona media and the Arizona press.
Chris Taylor was running for the Republican nomination to challenge Democrat Tom O'Halloran this November.
And tonight, Chris Taylor says he is seeking treatment for substance abuse.
We first met Chris Taylor in 2017 as we dug in on the opioid problem plaguing the eastern Arizona city of Safford.
In a previous campaign ad, Taylor opened up about his struggles with opioid addiction after two tours in Afghanistan.
Taylor, a veteran who fought off addiction to open his own treatment center, was poised to be the success story for Safford. But he went backwards as old demons resurfaced last week. A relapse that resulted in an overdose. In a statement to suspend his congressional campaign, Taylor was very direct, saying, quote, "I'm not going to hide from this. I'm not ashamed of what happened. I wish to sincerely apologize to the amazing people who have supported me. It's a haunting reminder of a dark past that will always be looking over the shoulder of a bright future."
All right, everybody. Welcome back to the Come This Far podcast with Chris Taylor. I'm your host, Chris Taylor, and it has been a little while since I have put out an episode. And there's many reasons for that, all of them good, none of them bad. I know that some of you have reached out to me via text message wondering if I was okay, and I truly appreciate that. I had just gotten on such a path of a flurry of episodes. Felt like I was recording a lot. Felt like I was, telling my wife and my daughter and my son to stay out there while I record. And that's fine every once in a while. But, you know, I had to really kind of prioritize why I decided to start this podcast was for a sort of a cathartic reason, for because it helps me process things and talk about things, and it's for my well-being. But you know, the number one thing that is for my well-being is being with my family and making sure that they are taken care of. So we have spent a lot of time together. Keep in mind, I have been writing chapters in my book vigorously, full time back in my bachelor's degree program. So that has kept me very busy. My wife and I are coaching our daughter, our 5-year-old daughter's t-ball team. And so that has been very busy. I began again, helping in my church with the youth program, which used to be with the Boy Scouts of America. I am an Eagle Scout from when I was a youth, and so I've been involved in the scouting program off and on as an adult. My church is no longer affiliated with the Boy Scouts of America because of their issues. So we run a program that's very similar. It's a young men's program to help them teach them things that they would learn in the Boy Scouts, but also more on the spiritual side of things and stuff like that. So I've been involved in that. I started training in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu about a month ago, and that has been a very humbling experience, a very challenging experience, one that puts me out of my comfort zone, and that's what I'm always looking for. I believe when I get so too comfortable, I get complacent and I don't challenge myself. A friend of mine that I've known for a very, very long time, he was actually a football coach of mine in high school. He's 8 or 9 years older than I am, so he was one of the young cool coaches, I guess you'd say. When you're a sophomore and junior and senior in high school, you have a guy that's in his 20s coaching, and he was a very big influence on my life. He is a black belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and he runs his own academy, and so he's been reaching out to me to be involved for a long time, and I finally took the dive. It's hard because of all these other things that I'm juggling, 3 or 4 nights a week doing Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. I have to prioritize all of that with the podcast, with the t-ball, with my church, calling and service, with, writing my book, with going to school, with being a father and a husband. And so, the podcast, because of that, has taken a little bit of a back seat. But that's okay. And I know that you understand that. And I'm grateful for all of you who have reached out to ask me if I'm okay. I will put out episodes and I may disappear for a number of weeks. Unless you see something on the news that I'm dead, I'm okay, basically. What else? Oh, another thing that I have gotten really involved in planning, coming up next week, April 16th. I turn 35 years old on April 18th. And so for my 35th birthday, I have planned a 35-mile backpacking excursion, hike, trek, whatever you want to call it. I'm going to start. I'm going to be inserted on the top of Mount Graham. If you don't live in the Gila Valley, you can Google it. Mount Graham is the prominent mountain feature that makes this valley that I live in one of the most beautiful locations in the world. The valley, the Gila River Valley that I live in Safford, Arizona, is right around 3,000 feet. The peak of the mountain is over 10,000 feet. And there is a road, Swift Trail, State Route 366 in Arizona, that you can drive directly to the top. And there is a large telescope, the Mount Graham Observatory. The Vatican, the Catholic Church, actually has their own telescope. I think it's called Large Binocular Telescope or whatever. Because of where we live, the light pollution is very low. The peak is 10,000 feet. They are able to study the cosmos, astrology, better than, I guess, anywhere on Earth. And there's other conspiracy theories as why the Vatican, the Catholic Church, would have their operations here. And I might get into that a little bit today. But so basically, I'm going to start. My father's going to drop me off at Heliograph Peak, which is just over 10,000 feet. And I have mapped out a 35-mile trek down the mountain. Not directly down. There's trails. There's existing hiking trails that may or may not be maintained very well. I've gotten some conflicting information about that, but you can imagine the terrain where the ponderosa pines at 10,000 feet down into the desert floor. The terrain is not one that you can just walk down. There's going to be some major terrain issues and problems, and I have a 40-pound pack that I'm going to be carrying that has all of my basic survival needs. I don't have a tent. I'm just going to sleep when I get to my halfway point, and I'm going to sleep overnight. I'm going to try to do it in 2 days. I do at the very least have to be back in Safford on April 19th because I'm getting my second vaccine shot, and I really want to be here for that. So if I don't make that hard timeline, then that's when I guess the search and rescue will come and find me. I do have checkpoints plotted throughout the whole route with 8-digit grid coordinates, with MGRS, which is a military grid reference system, as well as latitude, longitude points where I'm going to be around the route. So if I do not show up, somebody will have a very good idea of where I will be, or could be, or should be. I might not be anywhere near there, depending on how well I'm able to brush up my land navigation skills from the military. You know, this is just another thing that I've decided that I just need to challenge myself. Going into this, I thought maybe that the physical part of it was going to be the most challenging, because I am getting back in shape, but I'm nowhere near fighting shape, which is where I was when I was deploying to Afghanistan and fighting in combat. So you know, that is going to be an issue with the 40-pound pack on my back, and that nasty terrain. By the way, it's the largest valley to peak ratio in the whole state of Arizona. Anyway, but with the way the trails are, there was a major fire that devastated the mountain three or four years ago that wiped out many of the trails. There was lots of drainage and slippage and mudslides and rock slides that devastated part of the trails that I'm going to try to negotiate. And many of these parts, because if you go from 10,000 feet to 3,000 feet and you can drive a car going 25, 30 miles an hour, and it only takes you an hour to get to the top, you can imagine the grade is pretty steep in many of these places. And so negotiating that terrain with the pack and trying to stay on the existing trails, I do have the benefit of satellite imagery and GPS capabilities, apps and devices and all of this that I think I'm going to be able to stay on the least somewhat near the trail that I have mapped out, that I have plotted. But who knows? So I think that that's going to be a bigger maybe challenge, is just staying, just getting to where I need to be safely. Not so much the physical part of it, though. 35 miles in two and a half days is definitely going to be challenging. I think that the mental part of negotiating these this terrain and where these trails are non-existent or not maintained well or damaged by the fire is going to be very difficult. But that's why I'm doing it, to challenge myself mentally, physically, emotionally, spiritually. There is something special about Mount Graham. I've always known it. It's been a very important piece of my family history. My grandfather and grandmother loved the mountain. They would spend every off hour up there camping. You know, the Apache Indians, which the Apache reservation is right here in the Gila Valley. They believe that mountain to be one of the most spiritually significant mountains in the entire world. There is conspiracies that the reason the Vatican has their telescope there at the top of Mount Graham is that there is a portal that they are studying into supernatural. I don't know what you want to call. Obviously, if the Vatican is involved, they believe it has something to do with heaven or hell, or both. I don't know. There's been, you know, speculation that, you know, you hear of these, stargates, these gateways, into other realms, into other, worlds, into, you know, whatever, that is one of the conspiracies. And I don't know if those of you who don't really know my take on things when it comes to aliens and heaven and God and all of these things, ghosts, whatever you want to, you know, all of these paranormal and supernatural things that we deal with in this life. I'm going to do a podcast exclusively on this kind of things coming up probably soon, but I believe that in all of those things, and in a way that might surprise you, as a Christian, as a believer in a superior God, but I believe that all of those things are connected, and I will talk more about that later. Today, however, I'm going to jump in to something that I've been very keen on, that I've been watching very closely, not just the highlights from the media, but I've been watching the trial of Derek Chauvin, the officer that is accused of killing George Floyd, who's an unarmed black man in Minneapolis, Minnesota, last year on Memorial Day in 2020. Officer Chauvin allegedly put his knee on the neck of George Floyd and his other knee on the back, on his back, on a hard concrete for over 9 minutes, 9.5 minutes, until he was no longer breathing. And, you know, this case has so many different elements that I am very interested about, that I've talked extensively about. And it's sort of interesting how it's all playing out in the course of this trial. I think they're on day 9 or 10 now. This trial is expected to go several weeks. There has been some very compelling witness testimony and some very frustrating and very odd, I guess I would say, cross-examination from the defense. And I'm going to get into some of that right now. When I first saw George Floyd, this whole thing go down, it was very clear. And the reason I think it sparked so much national and international intrigue and all eyes were on it was that, you know, this was a case where there really nobody in their right mind would be saying, well, I would have done the same thing if I was Officer Chauvin, right? Because, you know, there's always those cases, whether it's I don't really want to get into some of the names of the cases, but you know what I'm talking about. There's always the case where, well, he had a gun and he was turning and it was a split second decision. He was in the car and he wouldn't show his hands. And then he reached for a pistol and you couldn't see that on the body cam, but it was there. There was one more recently that, well, when he was reaching back into the car, he was grabbing for a knife, you know, when you're pro law enforcement, which I think all of us should be, they do a very difficult job. They get a lot of scrutiny. And I believe that they deserve the benefit of the doubt, right? I do believe that. I am very critical of many police officers, and actions, but that doesn't come from a place of animosity, right? It just comes from a place from, man, you can do so much better. You know what I mean? And so when you see some of those things, it's like, man, I want to give that officer the benefit of the doubt. But when you see Officer Chauvin, with his body weight pinning Mr. Floyd to the ground for over 9 minutes, after he's in handcuffs, after he is no longer quote unquote resisting, why would you keep your knee on his neck and why would you keep your other knee on his back on the hard concrete? Nobody that I have seen has even tried to defend that. Now, I have seen people, and this is a major part of the trial, was that, well, George Floyd was a drug addict. He was committing a crime. He would have died anyway. He had all of these drugs in his system. His heart was very weak. He had heart disease. He had COVID a couple of weeks before. You know, it wasn't that Officer Chauvin killed him. It was that during the normal struggle that any, you know, regular healthy body would have survived very, you know, easily, he died because of the drugs in his system that depressed his breathing. He had heart disease, which made his body weak. The blood wasn't pumping the way that it would in regular people, unhealthy people. He had COVID, so his lungs were probably still recovering. And that is why he died. You know, he shouldn't have tried to buy cigarettes with that counterfeit money. He shouldn't have ingested fentanyl. He shouldn't have acted a fool when the cops were trying to put him in handcuffs and put him in the squad car. He should have just complied and he'd be alive. I have heard that extensively from people. And in fact, that is the defense's key line of defense. And when I first heard these things coming up before the trial, you know, when it was, you know, more information was coming out in the media because of all of the national and international riots that happened and the outrage and the all of these just major things happened. There was, you know, critics of this that said, well, yeah, but did you know that the autopsy showed that he had fentanyl in his system? Fentanyl kills hundreds of people every day. Did you know that he had COVID? Did you know that he had heart disease? Did you know that he was a drug addict for a long, long time? And that made me very angry and sad, because essentially what those people are saying is that because of those things, because he was a criminal, because he was a drug addict, because he was whatever, does it really matter that Officer Chauvin killed him? I mean, that's essentially what you're saying when you say those things. And I would think, well, there's no way that he died of an overdose, because when you take fentanyl and you die, you go through, you or any opioid, heroin, whatever, if you take enough of it to put you in a overdose, it doesn't happen like that. You don't just be normal for 10 minutes and then you kind of just fall asleep and usually you go into a coma. Most of the time it happens instantly if you inject it. Now, he ingested it, so it could take a couple more minutes, but he would have went unconscious in a coma and then gradually, because it shuts your central nervous system down, your brain stops telling your body to breathe, and then you die. That didn't happen. The video shows that he was struggling to breathe and to move so that he could get air into his lungs. He was talking, he was answering questions before he was down on the ground. And then, after a substantial time of not being able to get the oxygen in, he went limp and he died. And that was that. Until watching some of the testimony in the trial, I didn't know that he had ingested the fentanyl right as the one officer was tapping on his window. Mr. Floyd went into the Cup Foods, which was the store that he was buying cigarettes from. He had a $20 bill that he may or may not have known was counterfeit. I know that you say, well, how would he not know? Look, when you're dealing in the world of illicit drug trade, somebody could have gave him that $20 bill for a pill. And he could have got burned. Who knows? It's not like he knew. You can't prove that he knew that he was passing a fraudulent or a counterfeit bill. But even so, is that a crime that warrants guns drawn? and pulling you out of the vehicle and putting you in handcuffs and then throwing you to the ground and pinning you down in an illegal technique for over 9 minutes before you just die? No, in most cases, that would be a summons, a misdemeanor. Here, Mr. Floyd, you here's your ticket. You have to show up to court on this date, and if you don't, there will be a warrant for your arrest for failure to appear. That should have been the end of it, right there and then. But what I had learned later, and this is what got me thinking, second guessing even, is that, well, maybe that when he did ingest those pills to try to get rid of them so that he wouldn't have a possession charge on his hands, that would be about the time where, you know, he could have been experiencing an overdose on the ground. Just so happened, and it was coincidence, that there was an officer also impeding his ability to breathe. And so, yes, that overdose would be enough to then kill him. My question is, well, when he was clear that he was no longer moving and struggling and talking, when the other officer said, Mr. Chauvin, or Officer Chauvin, they called him sir because he was their training officer. Sir, you want to move him over to his side? You want to get your knee off of his neck? Multiple times they said that, and Officer Chauvin said, no, leave him here. And even when the paramedics showed up, not mind you, there was an off-duty firefighter from the city of Minneapolis who was one of the first witnesses to testify, was very compelling. She came off very educated. She knew what she was talking about. She was a trained EMT and firefighter. She showed up on scene. She happened to live in the neighborhood, and she said, what are you doing? He's not breathing. Check his pulse. And the four officers would not do it. The one officer, I'm going to butcher it, the Asian officer, stood guard and said, stand back. Officer Chauvin acted like he wasn't even reacting to the crowd. He wasn't even answering, like he was just stoic, relaxed. It looked like he had his hands in his pockets. That's been shown that he didn't. He was kind of just resting on his hips. He had one knee to the carotid artery, the other knee on Mr. Floyd's back, and for over 9 minutes he just sat there. You would think that after they had got him under control, he was in handcuffs, then they would roll him over and say, man, are you done? Because yeah, you know, they could think that he was resisting. He it was kind of frustrating when you saw Mr. Floyd kind of say, you know, oh, my knee, like he wouldn't get in the car. Like you could tell that the officers were up, you know, aggravated, like, come on, dude, just get in the car. Right. And he was, you could see how maybe he was playing up for, you know, oh, I'm hurt. I can't bend like this. I'm claustrophobic is what he was saying. And they're okay. You know, that's a common thing you see from people who are in handcuffs. It's like they'll do anything not to get into the car. And even though he wasn't fighting them, you know, you could argue that he was resisting to some degree. I don't think it was to the degree that warranted the actions that they took. At one point, Officer, why can't I remember these names? I'm so sorry. One of the officers drew his to serve his weapon and said, get your hand, you know, let me show your hands. It's like, it was escalated from the very beginning where it should have been de-escalated. And when we come back from the short little break, I'm going to get into a little bit more of the testimony and tell you where I stand, and where my mind did change a little bit. And we'll be right back. You're listening to the Come This Far podcast with Chris Taylor. All right, everybody, welcome back to the Come This Far podcast with Chris Taylor. We are talking about the Derek Chauvin murder trial and the death of George Floyd. I believe they are on day 10. I don't know. One of those days. When I originally, I talked about when I originally, you know, started to get the information about this situation, I thought, well, there's no way that he died of an overdose, because if he ingested enough drugs to overdose, he would have dropped and went limp and went comatose right away, and not gradually over 9 minutes would he have kind of just gradually stopped breathing or stopped being responsive or conscious. He would have lost consciousness, and you know, he may have had a pulse, he may have been breathing, but he would not have been coherent or alert or answering questions or talking or anything like that. He would have been completely out, and that did not happen. But then when I found out that he may have ingested the fentanyl pills as the first officer was knocking on the window, and he kind of was startled and was like, oh, you know, he then is when he maybe put some pills in his mouth and ingested them, and then I think he continued to do that, and you know, that may have been why he was stalling, why he was saying, oh, I'm claustrophobic, I can't get in, because he was trying to find a way to ingest the rest of the pills so that he wouldn't get a more serious charge of possession of narcotics. And, you know, and that is evidenced by the fact that they later found partially ingested or partially deteriorated pills that did contain fentanyl in them, and also there was DNA of George Floyd on them. These were found in the squad car that they searched. But so that did change my mind a little bit. Like, well, maybe, you know, the drugs did play a significant part in his death. And then yesterday we heard expert testimony from a forensic pathologist and a renowned pulmonologist who basically showed that the levels of drugs in George Floyd's system were in fact lower than the average DUI case. Well below the average autopsy numbers from people who did die of overdoses. Significantly lower. And somebody with George Floyd's tolerance, his girlfriend or fiance or what or whoever she was, testified of you know, how they met, where they met, their lives together, and it was extensive battle with opioid addiction. Mr. Floyd had what's called a high tolerance to opioids, and so not only was his levels in his blood much lower than the average DUI case, it was also, for somebody with a high tolerance, would have been very insignificant amount. My son is banging on the door here. Let me take one quick break. I'll be right back. You're listening to the Come This Far podcast with Chris Taylor. All right, everybody. Sorry about that. Welcome back to the Come This Far podcast with Chris Taylor. I am your host, Chris Taylor, and we are continuing to talk a little bit about the Derek Chauvin murder trial. They are on day 10, I believe, of the trial. We were talking about how the defense, their number one line of defense is that, you know, it was a combination of the drugs in George Floyd's system, his heart disease, the fact that he had COVID a few weeks earlier, and not the fact that he was held down with a knee to his neck and his back, handcuffs behind his back on the hard pavement for 9.5 minutes that killed him. And, you know, when I first heard about the drugs in his system and the fact that that was what their defense was going to be, I thought there's just no way. And then when I heard that, you know, he may have ingested the fentanyl as the first officer initiated contact with him by knocking on the window. He was sitting in the driver's side of the vehicle, and he kind of got startled, and he may have put some pills in his mouth and swallowed them, and then, you know, 5 or so minutes later, that's when he may have been experiencing an overdose. And that made me change my mind a little bit, to at least to the fact that, well, that is definitely more possible than the fact that, you know, he was high, you know, all day, or he ingested sometime earlier in the day, and then he went and bought cigarettes. He walked around. He drove. He interacted with friends and all this other stuff, and then he just suddenly passed out and died of an overdose. No, that just didn't. There's just no way that happened. And so when I heard about that, the fact that they found partially ingested fentanyl pills in the squad car with his DNA on them, which is odd because the police didn't find them, the prosecution didn't find those, the defense team found those after, months later. That I don't want to get into, you know, accusing the defense of doing anything nefarious like that. But those of you who have seen Making a Murderer know that police are capable of doing things like that. And so it was just, it doesn't help them that they are the ones that found them and not the countless other people who searched that vehicle. But that's neither here nor there. The expert testimony yesterday was very compelling, in that the world-renowned pulmonologist Dr. Tobin said that there's just he went so in depth of how the way he was positioned on the concrete, the way his hands were behind his back, the way that his the officer's knee was on the neck and the back, that he was struggling. He was trying everything to get enough oxygen into his lungs, and the way that it positioned and worked, he was just not getting enough oxygen. And that's what killed him. No questions. There's just no question about it. And the one thing that was very significant about this gentleman's testimony was that usually when you have these expert witnesses, these, you know, world-renowned experts or whatever they are, they are paid for their time, not only for their time testifying, but their time creating their report. They're billed at like $500 an hour, some crazy stuff. And so the defense can easily paint a, you know, at least a reasonable doubt in the, or a doubt in the jury's mind that, well, you know, of course he's going to say this. He's getting paid $500 an hour, right? He's getting paid tens of thousands of dollars to be here, to say exactly what the prosecution wants him to say. But what was crazy about this guy was, I'm not taking any money on this case. This case is so significant in that, you know, it's just such a slam dunk in that this is how he died. You know, with all of the social movement that came behind it, I'm not going to take a dime for this. And so that should be significant in the jury's mind that, okay, you know, he has no motivation other than, you know, just being an expert and saying, this is what happened. And he did not die because of drugs or because of heart disease or because of anything else, except the fact that he was killed and murdered. Then, you know, on the media, I heard, well, they could say that, yeah, he's not taking money directly for this case, but just the fact that it's such a high profile case, it's so significant to history, it's so significant to current events, to pop culture, to all of this stuff, that the money that he's going to bring in when he writes his book or when he does, you know, a documentary or interviews, you know, that's going to well compensate him above and beyond what he could make the case. And, you know, I could see that argument as well. But those people who put themselves in a position professionally to be in those positions, to be called upon in times of national significance and international significance, they are the foremost experts on whatever the topic of the day is, then, you know, they've put themselves in that position to be able to capitalize monetarily for writing a book, or, you know, why should they not be able to use their unique experiences to make money for their family? That doesn't mean that, well, their motives are impure. That doesn't equate to me. Everybody writes a book that is in a position like this. Everybody that gets to that pinnacle cashes in some way or another. But the fact that he is not taking any money for all of the hours and days of work that he's put into this trial and this case and this report and this testimony, to me spoke volumes about the solidity of that, what he's saying. The next expert that came was a police surgeon. He was a man that works for the Louisville, Kentucky Police Department as a surgeon. He often accompanies SWAT teams on dangerous missions so that he can be there in case one of them gets shot, or if somebody gets shot and all that. He's an expert in emergency medicine. That was the guy after. The guy after the pulmonologist was the toxicology expert. And he showed how the fact that, you know, anybody can say, oh, well, he had fentanyl and meth in his system. He had marijuana in his system. He had all these drugs in his system. Of course, that's why he died. And to the lay person, to somebody on the jury, would say, yeah, he was a drug addict, you know, that's probably why he died. That's why the defense is saying that. But with this testimony, they said he showed in very clear forms that, here is tens of thousands of cases that my lab, that I have personally reviewed, in that, you know, all of these cases where somebody died with fentanyl in their system, you know, the amounts, they do it by nanograms per milliliter or something, like, you know, whatever the cutoff is for a drug test. You know all these things, and I understand it, but I'm not smart enough to talk about it in intelligent terms. But I know that, look, this is the level of drugs in your system that will that should be fatal to anybody. Doesn't matter if you're opiate naive or you have a tolerance. And they talked about what that means, right? What does it mean to be opioid naive? That means that you know, somebody who has never had an opioid in their system, their opioid receptors, the mu receptor in their brain is completely clear and free. They can take a very small amount of fentanyl and they will die. They will overdose, or oxycodone, or heroin, or morphine, or codeine, or what, any opiate drug, they will die. Now, when you take opioids, even for a couple days, couple weeks, whatever, your tolerance grows. So that means that you need to take more of the drug to feel the desired effect. Whether that is to numb the pain that you had a tooth extraction, or you had surgery, they give you a month's worth of Percocets. You're supposed to take 10 milligrams a day, and by the time you get to that month mark, that 10 milligrams a day is not working as well as it did on day one. Right, your tolerance is growing, and for somebody like George Floyd, who has been using, who has been battling opioid addiction for many, many years, his tolerance would be very high. Not only that, but he's a big guy. He's like 6'3 or 6'4, 230, 240 pounds. He's muscular. He has all of this stuff. They charted all of these cases of fentanyl overdoses and fentanyl DUIs, where somebody is usually found asleep at the wheel in a parking lot or at a drive-through or a car wash, whatever, and they have the car on, they may have their foot on the brake, and they are just nodded out. They get a DUI, their blood is drawn, and this is the level of drugs that is in their system. He had thousands of those cases, and they charted those cases, right? They charted what that level was. That is significantly lower. That average of those DUI cases are significantly lower amounts of drugs than the fatal people who died with fentanyl in their system. So presumably died of a fentanyl overdose. Their level of fentanyl is much, much higher. George Floyd's level in his blood was lower, significantly lower than the average DUI case. Not just the overdose cases, but the average DUI case, where the person is, obviously, if you're charged with a DUI, you're alive and you're not dead. And this is the average number of these cases, tens of thousands that they reviewed and that they put into this graph and this study. And so he testified. He said it's categorically false that George Floyd could have died from that level of fentanyl in his system. It was lower than what is the average for a DUI that's charged. Somebody is charged with a DUI for having fentanyl in their system while they're driving a vehicle, or most often they're passed out in a parking lot somewhere with the car on and they're charged with DUI because presumably they drove that car from somewhere. But which is also significant that, look, when you're taking enough fentanyl to get a DUI and or to kill you, you are out. You are not walking and talking and saying I can't breathe and answering questions from the officers and complaining about pain, and you're not doing anything. Not only the ones who have died of a fentanyl overdose, you're out. You're done. You are not conscious, and you cease to breathe because of your respiratory depression, because your central nervous system is shut down and your brain no longer sends the signal to your body to breathe. It happens like that. Now, if you catch somebody in the midst of that overdose, you can revive them, you can breathe for them, you can pump blood to their heart, you can get their circulatory system going, and you can revive them. And that often happens with the DUI cases. And so the fact that George Floyd's level of fentanyl in his system was significantly lower than the average amount of DUI cases tells you that he did not die of a fentanyl overdose. Did it help him that he had fentanyl in his system? No, it most likely didn't help him. in that situation, right? But the fact remains that Officer Chauvin killed him. The police chief, Derek Chauvin's police chief of the Minneapolis police, testified that in no way, shape, or form was anything that Derek Chauvin did part of our operating procedures, part of our value system, anything, part of our training, nothing. He completely improvised. And he argued that in that situation, that level of escalation was just simply not warranted. You can escalate while you're trying to get the subject under control. You can put a chokehold or whatever, get the handcuffs on, and then what threat is the man to you after that? He has handcuffs on. There's four officers. What is he going to do? Kick all four of you to death? No, he's not. Grab him and put him in the squad car and take him to jail. Let him have his day in court. Instead, they pulled him out of the vehicle because he wouldn't sit down right, and because he was probably trying to hide those other fentanyl pills so that he wouldn't get charged with possession, because he didn't want to go to jail or didn't want to get charged with a significant crime. He knew that if he was going to get charged with fraud for a $20 counterfeit, he would probably most likely get probation or you know, have to pay a fine and have to make restitution to the store. But he would go on about his business, okay? But he knew that the more significant charge would be possession of fentanyl. And I believe these pills that they analyzed had a small amount of methamphetamine as well. And that is most likely just a contaminant or a filler that whoever manufactured the drugs just had a lot of meth lying around, and just to make the pill more, you know, the right size, they probably just put it in there. It wasn't the amount that what somebody would take to get high. The doctor, the guy also, the toxicology guy also testified that that level of methamphetamine was even significantly lower than what a doctor would prescribe. Yes, there is actually, amphetamine is an FDA approved in the United States to be prescribed at low doses. It's usually prescribed for ADHD or for obesity, for appetite suppression and stuff like that. And the level that George Floyd had in his system because of these pills, you know, you see that often with ecstasy pills. You have ecstasy, which the main ingredient is MDMA, but they also have oftentimes a level of heroin or a level of methamphetamines or a level of whatever, because they put that stuff in there to make the high more intense, with the MDMA also to make the pill the right size. It's just a filler, right? Instead of putting procaine or baby powder or laxative or you know, whatever they put in these drugs, why not just put a little bit of heroin or a little bit of meth? You know, it's going to make a better product for somebody who wants to get high. So George Floyd was not a methamphetamine user. He had a small amount of methamphetamine in his system because of these fentanyl pills, these counterfeit fentanyl pills that he thought he was taking. And this is a common thing as well. He thought he was taking an oxycodone pill. They make these counterfeit fentanyl pills. Sometimes they call them Mexican oxys. They are very dangerous for people because somebody may take them thinking that they're taking a 30 milligram oxycodone, which is significantly less potent than fentanyl. They take that pill and they die. But they usually go comatose and stop and are unconscious minutes after taking them. They don't do what George Floyd did when he was reacting with police. So some takeaways from this case, from what I've seen so far. I kind of talked a little bit about where I was in the beginning, and then hearing some testimony, I thought, well, yes, it's maybe it is possible that he died of an overdose. Then I heard the testimony from the toxicology expert and the pulmonologist, who said, no, that's not possible. This is the level of drugs he had in the system, way lower than even an average DUI case. He would not have overdosed, especially someone of that size and someone of that opioid tolerance level. It's just not possible that he would have died. Some takeaways from this case. The defense attorney, Mr. Nelson, is very what's the word I want to use to be diplomatic? I know what I want to call him, but I'm not going to say it. He's just a real horrible person, really. I know it's his job. I know that he is doing a job. He is representing a client. But the way that he questions some of these people, it often doesn't make much sense at all to anybody who has any understanding of addiction, who has any understanding of drug use, who has any understanding of emergency medical techniques. You know, it just doesn't make any sense. The one thing that really stood out to me in the very beginning of the trial was that when he was questioning the paramedics that worked on Mr. Floyd, he was and also the other police officers, the Mr. Chauvin's direct supervisor, a sergeant who's now retired. Then there was the lieutenant who was in charge of training all of the officers in the Minneapolis Police Department. Then the police chief and some other law enforcement experts. He was basically trying to say, well, you know, because the crowd was there, you had a number of people. You had a professional MMA fighter that was there. You had that off-duty firefighter EMT that was there. You had another bystander who was an older gentleman in his 60s or 70s, a black gentleman who was trying to tell George Floyd, brother, just go in the squad car. You're not going to win. You can't win. Just stop, stop fighting. You know, have your day in court, whatever. And basically the defense was trying to get at, well, this crowd was so hostile and they presented such a threat to these officers that is what distracted Officer Chauvin from being able to, do his job and protect the life of George Floyd. So was it not Derek Chauvin's fault, but it was this crowd that would not allow these officers to conduct their business peacefully, to get on with the arrest, to take Mr. Floyd into custody. It was in fact because of these individuals that were yelling and presenting a threat to these officers. The defense attorney talked about, well, you know, when you're getting shot at, it's often when police are getting shot at, or when soldiers are getting shot at, they get tunnel vision and they, you know, they can only, you know, focus on one thing, and that distracted him. And so basically he was trying to equate the fact that these bystanders were telling the officers, stop putting your knee on this man's neck, take his pulse. I'm a firefighter. I'm an off-duty firefighter. You have to check his pulse. He's not breathing. The MMA fighter who understands neck holds and positioning his body weight the way he was. He said, sir, he called him a bum after. He said, bum, you're a bum. Look at what you're doing. Get off of him. And somebody who I talked to you in the beginning, that I've started to train in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and I am rolling, they call it, with multiple very strong individuals, black belts and purple belts and blue belts, that are way better than me, stronger than me, way more, they know way more techniques. They're experts in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. The way that they, when I'm on the ground, the way that they position their body weight on me I can't breathe. It's scary. I have tapped out before, not being in a chokehold or an arm bar where my arm's going to break. Just the fact that their body weight is pushing me down. I'm on my chest on the mat. This mat has a give to it. It's soft. But the way that they put their body weight on me, my chest cannot expand. And yes, we're just training, so I'll tap out and you know, start again. But I can imagine in real life if I'm fighting somebody and my hands are behind my back in handcuffs and I'm on the concrete and they put their weight on my back and on my pushing against my carotid artery. Mr. Floyd, George Floyd, was tortured. That is torturous. I can't even stand it for 30 seconds. If I can't get out of that position, I tap out. I can't do it. They're strong. I can't breathe. That's what he was saying, and that's why he was trying to move like this. He was trying to get his right side of his lungs to expand. And the pulmonologist, one of the most striking things he said was the way that he was positioned and the way that he was struggling to get that air into his lungs, it was nearly the same as if a surgeon surgically removed his lung from his body. Not quite that significant, but very close. And that brought tears to my eyes, because nobody should have to go through that. I don't care if George Floyd was the worst human being to walk the streets of Minneapolis. I don't care if what he did, you know, what his struggles were. I don't care. Nobody deserves to be slowly tortured and killed like that, where your breath is just ripped from your body and your soul cannot take it anymore. And you die. That's just not, there's no justification. And which brings me to the point with, what is this defense even about? Because even if you're saying, yes, he died of an overdose, okay, well, there's four police officers there that are trained in saving somebody from an overdose. That is their job as public servants, as public safety. They are not there just to protect the well-off and the tax-paying citizens from these scumbags in their mind. That's not their job. Their job is to serve and protect everybody, every citizen of their city that they are serving. And so, yes, did George Floyd do some things that maybe warranted him to be arrested and put in handcuffs? Yes, he broke a law. He acted weird when they started questioning him about it. He was under the influence of drugs. But if that was the case, you have him in handcuffs. If you think that he's overdosing or you think that something's wrong, start CPR. Give him Narcan. Let the off-duty firefighter come onto the scene and take over until the medics get there. Why was that not done? So at the very least, even if the jury cannot convict him on second degree or third degree murder or even manslaughter, he should go to jail because he failed to do what he swore an oath to do, to protect and to serve. But it's my opinion that he did commit second degree murder or third degree murder. I don't quite want to get into that legalities. I'm not an attorney, but it's clear that Officer Chauvin's actions is what killed George Floyd. And that's it. Simple as that. That's where I stand. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Come This Far podcast. I will be doing another one as this trial unfolds more. I'll get into it a little bit more, but I just wanted to put this out. Thank you all for listening. Thank you all for checking in on me. I will be back in a few days with a new episode of the Come This Far podcast with Chris Taylor. Thank you so much for listening and watching.